Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan, for that introduction. And thanks to the organizers for inviting me here to San Diego to give an update on our progress in developing a therapy for the dry form of age-related macular degeneration. And what I'm going to tell you today is really a story of shown on this slide of going from a colony of undifferentiated human embryonic stem cells, shown on the left, to an implant of a differentiated cell, the retinal pigment epithelial cell, or RPE, derived from HESC, put on a scaffold and implanted in the human eye. And just in the way of disclosure, I'm co-founder with Mark Humayun and David Hinton of a startup company called Regenerative Patch Technologies. And I'll tell you a little bit about the company's involvement in the project as we're getting into clinical trials now. I'm going to start with a little video clip of a patient with age-related macular degeneration to give you a feel for how that disease progresses and what it's like to deal with it.
My name is Anna Kuhl. I have lived in Southern California since, since I was 22. In the beginning, I didn't notice anything different for a long, long time, except that my vision deteriorated and I needed stronger and stronger glasses. All of a sudden, I saw this big black area, and I was so surprised and scared that I called USC, the Eye Institute, right away and made an appointment for the same day.
Anna Kuhl came to us really looking for an advanced new technique to restore her sight. She had been going blind from a condition called macular degeneration. So what happens in this condition is the retina, which lines the inside of the eye, has light-sensing cells called rods and cones. And in this condition, macular degeneration, the rods and cones get affected in the center of the retina, the part that you read with, recognize faces, and watch television with.
When I realized that I have dry macular degeneration, my vision was still pretty good. But as time went on and I lost these cells,
then that area becomes atrophic, meaning completely degenerated and destroyed. So you end up with a black blind spot. Wherever you look, there's this blind spot. So if you try to look at somebody's face, there's a blind spot. If you try to read, there's this blind spot.
When I lost the central vision in my left eye, I had to give up many things that I used to do. I became much more dependent on other people.
So Anna Kuhl lives in Palos Verdes, just up the road. And she came down with a condition called dry macular degeneration. And the macula is a part of the retina, the tissue in the back of the eye that senses light, shown in yellow here. And it's a little small area, 1/10 an inch in diameter, that's important for your central vision. So in Anna's case, when she looked at something, she would see this big black blur in the middle of her visual field. So how do we treat this disease? Well, we know a little bit about what causes it. And in most cases, loss of vision is due to the death or dysfunction of a particular cell type called the RPE, or retinal pigment epithelium. And it's a support cell for the photoreceptors. So in this diagram, light is coming from the bottom and it hits the photoreceptors, the rods and cones up here. And then behind the photoreceptors is the pigment epithelium. Here's another cross section of the retina. now switched upside down from what you just saw, but you can see the RPE down here at the bottom with the photoreceptors indicated there. And what happens is light, in this case, comes from the top of the slide, goes through those inner neurons, hits the photoreceptors, and then a signal is sent back up to the retinal ganglion cells, which form the optic nerve and sends the information to the brain. So this RPE here is crucial. It provides key support functions for the photoreceptors, and without RPE, the photoreceptors don't work. One of the things that goes on is phagocytosis of shed outer segments of the rods and cones. In fact, every morning when light hits your eye, the photoreceptors shed the oldest part of the cell, which is at the tips of the outer segments, and those are eaten up by the RPE. And if you don't do that, a bunch of garbage accumulates and you lose visual function. There's also a whole bunch of transport that goes on. The blood supply for the retina is down below the RPE here, if you can see. And so a lot of factors come from the blood and are transported by the RPE to the photoreceptors. They also form a tight junction form the blood-retina barrier. And below the RPE is a key extracellular matrix called Bruch's membrane. It's not really a membrane. It's an extracellular matrix that supports the RPE, and that's what they stick to. So that's the normal retina. As AMD progresses, if you go into the optometrist, they may take a fundus photo, that bright flash that you get, and they may see these drusen deposits that are accumulating underneath the RPE. That's a hallmark of early macular degeneration. And in 90% of the cases, it can go towards dry AMD. The other 10% are wet AMD. And there are good treatments for wet AMD where you can get anti-VEGF inhibitors injected into the vitreous. But for the most prevalent form, there's really no good treatment. And you can see in the diagram here, the RPE die, the Bruch's membrane breaks down, and you lose visual function. And we don't know why it happens in the macula, but that's the area that where it happens, and you get this macular degeneration. So death of RPE leads to death of photoreceptors. And while in the past couple of years now, there are two drugs that have been approved by the FDA for treatment of dry AMD, they only slow the progression of the disease and they don't improve vision. And those are shots of complement inhibitors that are made into the vitreous. So as this diagram shows, there's evidence that some photoreceptors are kind of hanging around in this area where the RPE dies and photoreceptors die. And it's called geographic atrophy in this area. It looks, and I'll show you some pictures, it looks like a bit of geography where there's atrophy or dysfunction of the retina. So our idea, our strategy is to replace the RPE early in the disease progression before all the photoreceptors have died, to try and rescue these living photoreceptors and get them to regain function. So this story started back in 2010 when a group of us got together and we were awarded a disease team grant from the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which Evan mentioned. And of course, you know, Prop 71 was passed in 2004 and re-upped in 2020. And there are over 109 clinical trials now that have been enabled by CIRM, and thousands of students at all levels that have been trained. So our team, we called it the California Project Cure Blindness, was a collaboration between USC, UC Santa Barbara, Caltech, City of Hope, and this startup company called Regenerative Patch Technologies. And we were led by Mark Humayun, who you saw in the video, who's a retinal surgeon at the Keck School of Medicine. And David Hinton and I were co-PIs of this project. So our idea was this tissue replacement. Let's make RPE from pluripotent stem cells and put them in the eye in patients. So the first challenge was to decide where are we going to get the RPE? And it was known at the time that both human embryonic stem cells and induced pluripotent stem cells were capable of differentiating into retinal pigment epithelial cells. So we looked at both of those, and there's also a question of could we use allogeneic or could we use autologous iPS cells? And I'll tell you later, some people are trying the autologous approach, some are trying allogeneic. But in our case, we went with human embryonic stem cells because at the time in 2010, 2011, papers were coming out about how iPS may have mutations and changes in their DNA. And we felt that the FDA, the agency, was more comfortable at that time with human embryonic stem cells. So we went with stem cells. We tried various lines of human embryonic stem cells. And it turns out the H9 cell line from Wisconsin loves to make RPE. Other lines were not so good at it. H1, for example, was difficult to make RPE from. So it turns out if you grow H9 in a six-well dish like this and just take away the fibroblast growth factor, they start to differentiate into all different things. FGF keeps them in the undifferentiated state. And after some time, you could see pigmented colonies appearing, and those turn out to be RPE. So we call this sometimes spontaneous differentiation because you don't really have to do anything. You just remove the FGF and wait. And we developed methods to enrich them and grow them up to the point where we could get a nice pure culture, or at least greater than 99% positive for RP markers. And that's shown in the slide on the right here, where we stain for PMEL and RPE marker in green, and DAPI in blue showing the nuclei. And you can see almost all the cells are expressing that marker. So we've done a lot of work on this. We've also developed a method to more quickly make RPE. This takes a while. It takes like 100 days in culture to start to see these pigmented cells. And we've published a 14-day protocol where we can kind of force them to become RPE by adding growth factors. But when we went to City of Hope, our GMP facility, and told them about these methods to make RPE, they said, do the simpler one. You know, it's much easier just to remove something than it is to add factors if you're in a GMP environment, because for every factor that you add, you have to identify a source, audit the company making it, do adventitious agent testing, et cetera, for everything that you're going to be adding to the cells. So we went with this spontaneous, continuously adherent culture method to make RPE. And very importantly, we found that after prolonged culture, we couldn't detect any undifferentiated HESC markers. And that's important because a key concern of the FDA when using embryonic stem cell-derived cells is that you don't have cells that are undifferentiated, grow out of control, and make a tumor. So we did a lot of characterization of these H9 RPE. We looked at gene expression, and they express the normal RPE genes, the signature that you would expect from RPE. We also implanted them, growing them on a scaffold and implanting into the RCS rat model, which is a model where the RPE degenerates. It's not the best model for macular degeneration. In fact, there is no good animal model for macular degeneration, but it's a model of RPE dysfunction. And we could show rescue of the photoreceptors shown here in this H&E stain in the area where the implant was put in. And for the rat experiments, we had to make a really small implant and develop methods. And the surgery is completely different because they have much smaller eyes than humans. But we could also show in the rat that not only could we save these photoreceptors, but we could show that the photoreceptors were connected to the brain. And we did that by shining light on various parts of the rat retina and then recording from the superior colliculus and shown in this heat map here, the area of the SC that was connected to the area under the implant shows responses, whereas areas outside do not. So this work has all been published, and there's some references at the bottom. But our overall conclusion was that these cells express the right genes and proteins, and we could also show they carry out RPE functions, for example, that phagocytosis that I mentioned, and they could rescue photoreceptors in vivo. They're similar but not identical to fetal human RPE. And you can obtain fetal human RPE, and that's kind of our gold standard for comparison. But these are slightly different. We think they're a little more immature than human fetal RPE, and there are a few differences in gene expression. But we thought, based on this proof of concept in animal models, we had a good case to go forward into human clinical trials. So one question was how to deliver the cells. And if you think about treating an eye disease, the simplest would be just do eye drops. And for some things, like glaucoma, there are eye drops that are available. But we're talking about getting cells behind the retina, this yellow tissue here. It'd be great if we could inject just into the vitreous in the middle of the eye and have them crawl in there, but that hasn't worked so far. So we thought, let's do a subretinal injection of the cells. There are other methods now that are being developed where you can, instead of going through the vitreous and making a bleb here, you can actually go through the choroid and get to the subretinal space. But for us, it was to go to the subretinal space using methods that were familiar to retinal surgeons. Another question is, could we just squirt in the cells as a suspension and hope that they'll find the right place? Or should we grow them up first as a monolayer on a scaffold and put them in? So how to deliver the cells in the subretinal space, suspension or monolayer? Early on, we worked with Pete Coffey's lab on iPS-derived RPE and injected them into the RCS rat as a suspension. And what we saw was some rescue of photoreceptors, but the cells didn't last very long. The suspension RPE shown here, stained in green for human specific marker, form clumps and don't integrate into the monolayer, or very rarely so. We asked if these cells could undergo the phagocytosis I talked about. So to assay that, we stained in red for rhodopsin and green for the human cells. And every once in a while, you could see a few speckles of red inside a green cell. But there was really pretty much limited phagocytosis of outer segments. And that kind of makes sense because they're in a clump. They're not oriented properly with the apical side next to the RPE. Now, why do they die? Well, it's well known in cell biology that that cells need an extracellular matrix. Epithelial cells need an ECM to bind to stick to, and occupy their integrin receptors, which keeps them alive. And if they become detached from the ECM, they undergo apoptosis. So we knew that from studies in human that Bruch's membrane is damaged in geographic atrophy, and suspension cells may lack a functional ECM to support them. So this has been a question in general in regenerative medicine. Should you put cells on a scaffold or not? How to deliver the cells so that they'll survive? So after a lot of explorations of different scaffolding materials, our approach was to grow H9 HESC RPE on a scaffold made of perylene. Perylene is a xylene polymer that's biocompatible and has been used in implantable devices for over 30 years. So for example, if someone gets a pacemaker, it's in their heart, it's usually coated with this perylene material. So our innovation, which came from YC Tai's lab at Caltech, was to make the perylene as a membrane that you could peel off and put cells on. Most people just use it as a coating of different things. But we grow the RPE such that they develop into a monolayer and they're polarized. They have a basal side with the nucleus down here and an apical side with these little hairs or apical microvilli that stick up here. And we engineered this such that it was had diffusion characteristics very similar to the native Brooks membrane. It's made with ultra-thin regions with a thicker meshwork of perylene. So it's about 0.5 microns thick. And if you do diffusion experiments, it's very similar to Brooks membrane. Now it's biostable, it doesn't break down. And we looked at biodegradable scaffolds. Some people are trying those, but in our hands, they turned out to be toxic to the retina in many cases. And so we settled on this scaffold of perylene. And to get the cells to stick, we coat it with vitronectin, an ECM protein that engages the integrin receptors on the basal side of the RPE. So here's a picture from David Hinton's lab, a scanning EM of a perylene C substrate with H9RPE showing these apical microvilli on the cells. We worked on different sizes of scaffold and played around with different types of scaffold, but our final product we called CPCB-RPE1, very catchy name, but it stands for the California Project Cure Blindness RPE1. And it looks kind of like a wine bottle with a little Snoopy nose up on the right side. And if you zoom in, you can see these ultra-thin regions as circles and the RPE cells forming a monolayer. Now, why do we have this little nose on there? Well, that's for the surgeons. We want to make sure they put it into the eye with the apical side opposed to the photoreceptors. So they know, looking at it, that it has to be in this orientation when they put it into the eye. Now, a lot of cell therapies use millions and millions of cells, and it's hard to follow them. The eye has advantages in that we can use fewer cells. This is about 100,000 cells, and this device is about 3 by 6 millimeters, so it's very small. And we can actually see it after we put it into the eye. So there are advantages compared to, say, working in spinal cord, where when you inject the cells, it's very hard to follow them and see if they're still living and see what they're doing. So the road to the clinic was interesting, and we were funded by CIRM with this disease team grant to get to an IND, investigational new drug application. And we had to do a lot of preclinical studies in animal models. We had evidence from our labs that it could rescue cells in the RCS model, but that's not good enough for the FDA. What they want to see are called GLP studies, good laboratory practice studies done by an outside contract group. And we used a company called Absorption Systems right here in San Diego. And there's a picture. We brought some of our people down to do rat surgeries and culture cells. And we had to show efficacy and lack of toxicity in the eye using the RCS rat model. we had to show tumorigenicity, lack of tumorigenicity in nude rats. And to do this, we put the whole human dose into a rat eye, let the nude rat live 9 months, its entire life, and then sent out all the tissues to be cut and stained with H&E to look for human tumors by another contract lab to show that no tumors were appearing. We also had to figure out the surgery. How do you put this thing in a human eye? And as I mentioned, the rat eye is much smaller. And we went to the Yucatan mini pig, which has an eye about the same size as a human, and surgeons worked out methods to deliver the implant in pigs. FDA also wanted us to look at delivery studies in a human eye, in a post-mortem cadaver eye, so we did that. And they were concerned. We made an injector device that I'll show you in a minute, but one concern was, if you just load this scaffold with cells into the injector, does that stress the cells? So we did experiments where we would load, unload, load, unload, load, unload, and look at cells and expression of markers, and showed that it didn't harm the cells. So through all these, we established activity and safety in animal models, and we were able to, at the end of our CIRM disease team grant, write an investigational new drug application, about 13,000 pages long. I asked the FDA, I said, does one person actually read this thing? And they said, no, a bunch of us read different parts. So it's pretty boring reading, but they wanted every study. They have 30 days to review it, and we were on hot standby in case they had questions. The 29th day, they called us and said, what were the weights of the animals in study number 5? The body weights. And we're like, oh my God, did we record the body weights? And we did, but that was their only question. And really importantly, in all these studies, we didn't see any tumors forming. And in our human studies, we haven't seen any tumors forming. So after this, we during this, we worked with City of Hope to make the RPE patch, we call it, under good manufacturing process, or GMP. And again, the method was that spontaneous adherent culture method where we have a master cell bank of H9 cells. We remove the FGF, we wait, they differentiate, we then enrich them, and then we importantly have an intermediate cell bank of RPE that we can freeze down. So that makes it a lot easier. We don't have to do this process every time we do an implantation. When we're ready to implant a patient, we thaw a vial of the cells. We grow for 30 to 58 days on the implant, on the scaffold, put that in a vial, and kept it at 37 degrees the whole time, drove it across town from City of Hope to USC, where the surgeries were done. Now, interestingly, during the process of making the cells for the trial, City of Hope was really booked, and they were saying, well, we're not ready to make these. We don't have enough people. So Jane Lepkowski called me up one day and said, can some people from your lab come down and learn to do GMP manufacturing? And I said, okay. How many people do you need? And she said, 6. And I was like, that's like my entire lab, but okay. So they drove down to Duarte and learned to do GMP manufacture. And there they are, and they were able to make enough implants for the phase 1 study. Let's talk about now the clinical trial, the phase 1 trial. It was funded by CIRM, which is now called a Clin 1, or I guess, yeah, Clin 2 grant. I'm not sure. Now it was just called a phase 1 trial grant back then. We planned to do this as an open label, meaning that patients knew they were getting our implant. There was no placebo. We proposed 2 cohorts of 16 subjects, And the dose was one size fits all. A lot of times trials have dose escalation. Ours was just one implant. And because these are allogeneic cells that are mismatched or not matched to the patient, we use systemic immunosuppression during the period around the implantation for a total of 60 days. The primary endpoint was safety, of course. And we also wanted to look, though, at visual function to see if there was any improvement or maintenance of visual acuity. We tried a whole bunch of exploratory outcome measures, and I can talk about those in more detail, but mostly I'm just gonna talk about the visual acuity. So this was a 12-month trial, that was the end, but then we're continuing to follow up with patients. So we wanted patients with GA, geographic atrophy, dry AMD, and FDA wanted us to start with patients that were actually legally blind. They were 2200 or worse. They allowed us to go to earlier patients in the second cohort, but in the end, we ended up using all patients that were 2200 or worse, so they were legally blind. We had a lot of exclusion criteria. They couldn't have other diseases, and importantly, they had to have had cataract surgery. They had to have their lenses replaced, so they're called pseudophakic. And that's because when you remove the vitreous, often if you have a lens there, you'll develop cataracts after. And we didn't want any history of malignant cancer. Turns out when you go on immunosuppression, sometimes cancer can reappear. So we didn't want that. We ended up saying no cancer in the last 5 years. So we started recruiting patients. All of the surgeries were done at USC, but we had partners at various retinal clinics, mostly around California, one in Phoenix, that would refer patients to USC Roski Eye Institute. And the leader of the study was Dr. Amir Kashani, who is an assistant professor at USC, who has since moved to Johns Hopkins. So here's the timeline for the patients. They would be screened. We would do baseline studies, taking pictures of the eye and doing OCT to look at the retina. And then at day minus eight, we started them on tacrolimus, low-dose immunosuppression, systemic immunosuppression. And one concern was, these are elderly patients. Is it going to be okay to put them on immunosuppression because they're prone to, you know, other effects? And the transplant surgeon advisors recommended that we do this and said, you know, you want to give your implant the best chance possible to survive. And there are a lot of people on immunosuppression that do just fine. So we heeded their advice. But after 60 days, we stopped the tacrolimus. We tapered off. The idea was, we're going to cut a hole in the retina and put this thing in there. We're damaging the blood-retina barrier. There could be an immune response. So we have that immunosuppression around the time of the surgery. But then the retina heals, and it's a somewhat immune-privileged site in the back of the eye. So we watched very carefully at day 60 to see if we could see any infiltrate of immune cells, and we didn't see that. So let's look at the surgery now. Here's an animation showing the surgery, and I'm sorry if you're squeamish about sticking needles into eyeballs, but this is what they do all day long, and they're used to it. First, they remove the vitreous, then they do a subretinal injection here to detach the retina. The retina is lifted up here. The RP are back here. They cut a hole in the retina, a retinotomy, small hole. And here's the implant. And we developed this injector tool that's basically a cannula with a forceps inside. So you grab onto the implant, it folds up like a taco and goes into the cannula, and that protects the cells as you go through a port through this retinotomy and then release the implant under the eye, so under the retina. And so the apical side of the RPE is now opposed to the photoreceptors that they need to need to support. We used oil to silicone oil to push down the retina so that the retina would not detach. And in some cases, they had to seal up the retinotomy with a laser. The first patient was treated February 16th, 2016 at USC. The surgeon was Amir Kashani, shown here, along with an assist from Mark Humayun and another surgeon who watched, Firas Rahal, who will be part of our second clinical trial. So that animation looked really smooth, right? Easy peasy. Well, it's not that easy. It took some learning, really. And here's an actual intraoperative video of patient 130, where they've made a bleb here, detached the retina. But here's the problem. The geographic atrophy is hard to detach from the retina. It's a scar, basically. So they had to devise methods to basically go in and hydrodissect, squirt fluid in there to gently lift off the retina, which is damaged and very thin there. And here you can see our injector coming in with the implant now extruding through this retinotomy and unfolding. And they do this by hand through a microscope. So Mark Humayun told me he doesn't drink coffee because you can't have a tremor when doing this. So they have to adjust it a little bit, reposition underneath the retinotomy. There's the retinotomy site. Here's the GA in this patient. And then they fill with silicone oil to push the retina back down. They've got this procedure down to about 2 hours now as an outpatient procedure. The first patient, it took longer and she did spend the night in the hospital, but all the patients since then have not had to spend the night in the hospital. So a lot of learning. Everyone wanted to know what's going on. When we didn't report anything, everyone said, oh man, maybe it didn't work. So we thought, okay, we're gonna do an interim report of the first five patients. And that was published in Science Translational Medicine. And here's a picture of the implant that I showed at the beginning. Here's the geographic atrophy area, and the implant covers most of the GA. So in the first five patients, we saw some patients actually improve, and most stayed about the same. So we published that, but went on, and I'll skip that data and go to what we've published more recently. We had a one-year follow-up paper. 15 out of 16 patients were successfully implanted. There was one where they had difficulty implanting the implant. It wouldn't unfold properly, and they think there was some bleeding and some fibrous material that they couldn't deal with, so they aborted the procedure, unfortunately, in that patient, and that patient was fine after that. But all these patients were legally blind, 2200 or worse, as I mentioned. We this year published a long-term follow-up looking after 3 or 4 years in some cases at these patients, and it showed that we had durable outcomes. So first, let's look at some pictures and see some of the results. First question was, does the implant stay there? Is it stable? Do you still see cells on the implant? So here's implant stability. Here's the baseline in this patient before the surgery. There's the geographic atrophy in the macular region. Here's year one, year two, year three, year four. And we could see that the procedure was safe, and I'll get into that in a minute, but that the implant in all patients stayed in the same place, and we didn't see much evidence of cells crawling off. Remember, these are cells that have formed a monolayer and are held together by tight junctions. I think only one or two patients we could see some black spots coming off of the implant. And I won't lie to you. I'm not going to say this is a typical result. This is our best result. And in a phase one trial, there's a lot of learning that goes on, but this actually is, and she's allowed us to identify her, but this is Anna Kuhl, who you saw in the video at the beginning. Okay, what about safety? Well, we assumed there were going to be some events associated with retinal surgery that we might see. So the clinicians concluded, and our data safety monitoring committee concluded, that there were no unanticipated SAEs, severe adverse events, related to the implant, the surgical procedure, or the immunosuppression. Importantly, we didn't see any tumors, no sign of tumors. But there were some SAEs, and as I said, it was a learning experience, and in the first cohort, we saw a bit of retinal hemorrhaging in 4 out of 8 patients, some edema, some focal retinal detachment or RPE detachment, but the surgeons made adjustments as they learned this procedure, and hemorrhage was mitigated in the second cohort of 8 patients by improved hemostasis. Using diathermy around the retinotomy to prevent bleeding. 1 in 8 patients in the second cohort had an ocular SAE, and these are all published now if you're interested. There were 2 SAEs related to immunosuppression. 1 patient had pneumonia, another had weight loss, both of which resolved. So we were anxious to see, is there any effect on visual acuity? And in this case, we use the ETDRS chart, not like the usual one you see with the big E, but in this case, every line has 5 letters. And you're looking for improvement in the number of letters that the patient can see over time. What we found is that 27% of the patients showed a greater than 5 letter improvement in the implanted eye. So 5 letters is one line. So that's considered significant. There's some variation in these data. If a patient comes in one day and they're tired, they may not do so well. If they come in the next day and they've had 5 cups of coffee, they may do better. So, you know, plus or minus a couple letters is common. So greater than 5, we thought that's significant. Importantly, 60% of the subjects were either stable or improved in the implanted eye. And that's a win, too. If they don't get any worse, that's really good. So, as I mentioned, there were durable outcomes with now a follow-up average of 34 months, and we're continuing to follow these patients. And we didn't do a control, a placebo, but the fellow eye is somewhat of a control. It's not perfect, but in this case, only 1 fellow untreated eye improved, and 80% lost 8 to 21 letters over the same time period. So let's look at the patient's perspective now. Here's Anna Kuhl again.
After the procedure, my life changed in many ways. I could tell so soon afterwards that something was happening in this eye. When I could see whole faces on the TV, and also the whole face of Hans, my husband, and other people, because I had a very hard time recognizing people before. If you don't recognize people, you don't even like to be, you know, go to parties or anything. And now I like parties again.
So that's one patient, and you know, it was a small trial. We need to do more, obviously, and I'll talk about that at the end. But one question I get often is, what about putting cells in this area of geographic atrophy? It's a potentially toxic environment. It's a big glial scar. Will the cells survive? And even though we could see them on the implant, we can't say whether or not those cells are living or dead. Fortunately, we've consented almost all of our patients to donate their eyes if they pass away. And one patient in this study did pass away from other causes, and we were able to obtain the eye and look for our cells 2 years after the implant. And we've published this work. And what we found was that we could detect cells 2 years after implantation in an eye with severe geographic atrophy. This patient was one of the worst in the trial. They could only see hand motion through that eye. They had a huge GA. But in this case, we could definitively show that the cells we were looking at were the implanted cells. And here's just some data from that paper showing the pigmented cells on the patch here. And we could stain for RPE65, a cell in the visual, a protein in the visual cycle shown here. We could show the cells were polarized by staining for sodium potassium ATPase. And even though this patient didn't have too many photoreceptors, in areas where there were photoreceptors, we found limited but some evidence of phagocytosis by the implanted cells of this rhodopsin in red and the implanted cells in green. And we could definitively show they were our transplanted cells because they had a different HLA antigen compared to the recipient. So here's a mismatched, completely mismatched cell that survived after 2 years with only a short course of immunosuppression. So it's N equals one experiment, but we hope to look at more patients to see how this goes. And one question is, okay, some cells survived. And the guy in the back row is saying, yeah, but how many cells survived? Good question. And we don't know that yet. We're trying to analyze this further and quantify, but over 6 millimeters of implant and 3 millimeters wide, that's a lot of area to look at in sections. So we're working on that. Okay, so let me wrap up. So going forward, we've improved the production of the implant. One problem is the phase one trial, we had to keep it at 37 degrees, and we had a little portable incubator we had to drive across town for the surgery. If we're gonna do this all over the country, we need a better way to do it. And so we figured out how to cryopreserve the cells on the scaffold. And now we can ship them to the point of care, thaw them, and implant them. We've also worked on ways to culture the cells at higher scale on microcarriers. And it's a work of Mohammed Finas here, showing these cells on microcarrier beads. And then looking forward, like this guy in the picture. And by the way, if you're a retinal surgeon, you shouldn't be looking at the painter while you have a needle in a child's eye. That's not a good idea. But anyway, looking forward, we're planning to do a larger phase 2B trial using the cryopreserved implant at 5 different sites and now including a placebo arm. And we've obtained funding from CIRM, the Marcus Foundation, and the Al Mann Institute, and we're busily making that implant right now at City of Hope. And we hope to implant the first patient at the beginning of next year. So we're not the only ones doing this, and I wanted to mention the sort of cell therapy landscape in the eye. Even though we don't think cell suspension is the best approach, it's easier. And so a lot of folks have tried putting HESCRPE and other cells into the subretinal space just by injection of a suspension. Stellus, ACT, Okada had done a phase one trial, and they're gearing up to do more trials now. CellCure, Cell Lineage has done a phase one trial in Israel with a suspension. And New York Stem Cell has done one patient. UCLA is doing an iPS autologous approach. And I think your next speaker is in this series is Bill Lowry, who will talk about that work. A couple trials were discontinued. They actually tried blood mesenchymal stem cells from cord blood. That was discontinued. And then a neural progenitor stem cells, Inc. was discontinued. Others are trying a monolayer like we are. The group in France is working on orphan RPE diseases, and I'm not sure how many patients they've implanted, But they're growing cells on a biodegradable membrane. I know that in Japan, they've done one patient on with cells on a scaffold. NEI has done one patient with autologous iPS on a biodegradable scaffold. The London project has done four patients for wet AMD with cells on a scaffold, different cells, different scaffold. And I understand now they're going to a suspension and gearing up for that. And I mentioned our work with 15 patients. So just in conclusion, I've shown you that we can make these cells, and I didn't go over the FASTER protocol that we've developed, but that's been published. And we figured out novel surgical methods to deliver the cells and reported the results from the first 15 patients. And again, 27% showed improvement of 5 letters or more, 60% improved or maintained visual acuity. And we detected surviving cells 2 years after the implant, despite the mismatch. So a lot of people contributed to this work in the California Project to Cure Blindness. And this has now been taken up by the startup company, Regenerative Patch Technologies. Wanted to acknowledge people in my lab. They're jumping for joy because they're right on the beach in Santa Barbara. Wanted to thank our funders, especially California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And here's a picture from the ISSCR meeting in 2019 when the lab members that made the cells got to meet Anna Kuhl, which was really cool. And she wanted to thank each of them individually. And we're hoping that there'll be more patients like Anna in the future. And then finally, wanted to acknowledge the patients because they're like astronauts going into space. They are read the Riot Act in the consent form. They're told you could go blind, you could lose your eye, you could get an infection, and they say, go ahead. You know, so we thank them for their participation, and I thank you for listening. Thank you very much.
So as usual, there's some gymnastics between taking questions on Zoom and in the room, but those in the room get priority.
This is wonderful. I'm so glad that you and everyone else is making progress. I'm sorry? Oh, Jean Loring. I guess I was supposed to say that. Who are you, she said. What I'm curious about is the phase two and how you're going to manage a placebo control when all you have to do is look in the eye and know whether or not people got a transplant.
Yeah, good question. And that was something we discussed a lot. Dr. Humayun's been involved in a lot of surgical trials. And what we've arrived at and talked to the FDA about is for the placebo arm, they would not get an entire retinal surgery because that's too dangerous. There's so many possible side effects that you can get. And so... the idea is that they would be put under anesthesia like other patients, but they would just debride the cornea a little bit, and then wake them up after 2 hours, and they'd feel something in their eye, and they would go through the follow-ups, but would not be told. So it's a blinded study. Excuse the reference,
but that seems unnecessarily complex. I know that in Europe there is a movement towards, for surgeries like this, to not have a placebo control and instead have a group of people who would serve as a with similar disease and look at progress comparatively. And I certainly am hoping that the FDA decides to adopt something like that as well. For this kind of therapy. And there have been some people, of course, who've been trying to advocate for that for the dopamine neuron transplants for Parkinson's disease with some success. And I imagine you have some European counterparts who have different regulations to deal with.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we've talked about, a historical control, basically looking at the history of what you would expect for a patient with this disease and compare to that. Going forward, and of course, you know, just scratching the surface of the eye is not the same as, it's not really the best scientific control, right? You want to go, maybe you'd want to put in a patch without any cells and see what happens. But again, yeah, it's very different kind of clinical trial than using a oral pill or something.
That last thing really sounds absurd, honestly. If you step back just a little bit, realize putting something in that you know is not going to work is just, it seems borders on cruelty.
Well, I mean, talking to the ophthalmologists that have been involved in some of these trials, the patients really want to get better, right? So it's they'll really say, oh, it's working. I can see better out of that eye just because they want to. But then when you do the eye chart and other tests, they're not really improving, even though. So patient reported outcomes are not trusted. So we want them to think that, okay, you got the implant. So because we're going to do a lot of testing on those people as well.
Yeah.
So that's the idea.
So the type of experiment you're doing here obviously is very different than what we do in the lab. But often in the lab, we would take our first sort of shot at it, go through those different experiments and try to figure out why certain patients or subjects in your experiment did better than others. How much time do you spend doing that versus obviously having to stick to the protocol of this clinical trial where you want to push forward and increase your N?
Yeah, good question. And that's a key question. Why did some improve and some didn't? What's different about them? And we're looking at that now. And one thing we want to do, which we haven't done yet, is to look at their genotype, their known risk alleles for AMD. And in fact, they come mostly, the two biggest ones, one's on chromosome 1, one's on chromosome 10. What's the difference in their genotype? What we've done in our analysis so far, what seems to be the case is that the smaller the GA, the better the patient did. And that makes sense, right? Because they're earlier in progression of the disease, they have more photoreceptors. And so in our phase two, I didn't have time to mention, we're planning to go into really early in the disease, 2060 to 2200. With the hope that we can preserve the photoreceptors that are there. And in the lab, in animal experiments, you can do things and test more conditions, and we've done a lot of that. But again, we're hampered by the fact that there's not a great animal model for AMD. You know, the RCS rat is accepted by FDA as a model of RP dysfunction, and if you can show rescue there, they'll say okay. But still a lot of questions to answer.
But are there any more detailed studies you can do in those patients, any electrophysiological or anatomical, very detailed anatomical studies that you can do to correlate success with?
Yeah. One of the things we're planning to do in the phase two is to do microperimetry, where you shine spots of light of varying intensity, different places in the retina before and after transplantation. And FDA has accepted that as an endpoint for, especially for glaucoma studies, where they say, if you can see an improvement of 7 decibels in 5 or more spots that you pre-select, they would say that's efficacy. So we've only been able to do that so far in one patient in the phase one, but we're looking at that. We've looked at other measures of visual function like contrast sensitivity and other tests. Some people have done reading speed, for example. So a lot of things there. But again, thanks to these patients, because they're poked and prodded and tested and tested and tested, and they're willing to do that, that it's going to take a lot of that.
Let me take a quick, why don't you pass the microphone to her, and let me take another question is interesting. The questioner wants to know, how does somebody get enrolled in a phase two trial?
How does somebody get enrolled? Yeah, so there's a screening process.
We have a volunteer.
Yes, well, we haven't quite started recruiting yet for the phase 2B, but the way to do that would be to get in touch with a retinal Patch Technologies, the company that's regenerative patch technology, sorry, that's doing the trial, or contact me and I can put you in touch with the right person. But as I mentioned, there are exclusion criteria, and if you fit, and you know, you could talk also to your ophthalmologist and they would be able to advise you.
Great. Go ahead.
This is Sybil Hauser with Open Biopharma Research and Training Institute, and we are a CIRM. We also do CIRM training, so very nice to hear that this was kind of through a grant of CIRM. My question is with regard to immune suppression. The eye is an immune-suppressed area. There are already some allogeneic stem cell approaches in the gut area where you don't need immune suppression. How much do you need? Because this is another risk for patients undergoing this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that part of the transplantation?
Yeah, good question. And other people, for example, the London Project is trying just a localized immunosuppression where they put in a pellet in the vitreous that secretes immunosuppressive agents, and that might work. And they haven't seen immune rejection in their, at least they published on two patients and have not seen immune rejection. So we were limited just in terms of how many approaches we could take. We thought about at one point trying an arm with just localized immunosuppression. In one of the pig studies, we didn't use any immunosuppression and saw cells surviving. So I think it's still an open question about what's the best approach there. We followed in the footsteps of ACT that had done a 90-day immunosuppression. The clinicians thought we could do less than that, so we went with 60. But maybe even less would work. You know, as I mentioned, we do cut a hole in the retina. There's some hemorrhaging. And so there's some loss of the blood-brain barrier, the retina blood barrier. So some immunosuppression is probably a good idea. Others are trying, you know, match cells or cells that have their HLAs removed, so-called, you know, invisible to the immune system. So it's still an open question, and I think it's still early days. We might come up with better ways.
Great. Well, while we're waiting for any questions in the room, let's take one from on Zoom. In the patient who you reported the post-mortem data was available, how did the number of photoreceptors in the treated eye compare to the fellow untreated eye?
How did the number of photoreceptors compare in the untreated versus the treated? Yeah, in this patient, as I mentioned, they had a huge area of geographic atrophy and had hand motion vision only in the treated eye. So there were very few photoreceptors in the area of the implant. We had to look pretty hard to look for that phagocytosis that I showed. So the untreated eye, we did look at that eye too, and it had more photoreceptors. But we didn't quantify that yet. We're still examining that one eye and or both of those eyes, and there's still some open questions. Like I mentioned, how many of the RP cells survive? We don't know that. We'd love to say, you know, 90% or 50% or whatever, and so those studies are ongoing.
So are these some the phagocytic nature of RPEs? Does that mean they're like microglia, like myeloid lineage cells that migrate into the retina?
They're derived from they have a neural origin, but it's different, not immune origin, not from blood, but they do have that phagocytic ability, and they've looked at some of the molecules involved. There's an integrin alpha V beta 5 involved and MERTK. So they know some of that pathway, and then the phagosomes fuse with the lysosomes and they degrade the material. But it's, yeah, there's some similarities to immune cells, but a lot of differences as well. Yeah.
So one more question. You mentioned GWAS hits on chromosomes 1 and 10. Is that only for the dry form, or is it also for the wet form? Are the wet form completely distinct? Because you mentioned VEGF or inhibitors.
Question. Yeah, both forms are thought to be due to a loss of RPE, and they have dissected some of the genes that are involved, or they think are involved, or at least risk alleles for both forms, and still trying to sort that out. And it may in the future, you know, predict or inform our approaches to treatment. The big difference is that in the wet form, the blood vessels from the choroid sprout and grow through the Bruch's membrane into the eye. And if there's a bleed, they're not very good blood vessels, they're leaky. And if there's a big bleed, that's really dangerous, and you can go blind very quickly from that. So luckily, there are treatments using VEGF inhibitors, antibodies to VEGF, like Lucentis and Avastin, and then VEGF receptor soluble versions of that, like Eylea, that actually prevent that. And for most patients, that works. But you know, you get an injection once a month or once every 2 months, and you've probably seen ads on TV with Henry Winkler and people hawking these drugs that are mostly effective. But that being said, some patients with wet AMD do not respond to the drugs. So, and for the dry form, these complement inhibitors, as I said, they slow the progression, and their endpoint was the size of the geographic atrophy, looking at that in patients, and they've done wonderful, very involved studies. But again, it seems to only slow the progression, and they don't see improvement in their vision. So still a lot of work to do.
Why don't you move the mic there? In the meantime, I'll just, some of the questions on Zoom are actually somewhat related to what questions Angina was talking about. In terms of the mechanism of therapeutic action of the RPEs, is it things that they secrete or things that they do in terms of phagocytosis? And did you need to provide a secretome to the FDA or make that part of your release criteria?
Good question. We think it's both. We have seen in animal studies survival of photoreceptors beyond the implant, suggesting that they are secreting something. And a couple of papers have come out now from Dr. Humayun's lab showing that if you just collect the conditioned media of RPE grown in culture and inject that into the RCS rat, you see some rescue. So there's a study now investigating whether or not you could simply treat AMD with this secretome. So FDA did not ask for that, but we have started to look at that. For example, we know that RPE secrete PEDF, which is a factor that helps photoreceptors, and we've been monitoring that in some of our experiments. And they also secrete VEGF on the basal side to enrich the choroid. So yeah, they're known to secrete a number of factors, and that could be a big part of the story.
Okay, we'll take one last question here and then one on Zoom. Okay.
Hi, I'm Jolene Rudell. I'm an ophthalmologist and a clinician scientist here at UCSD. So for an ophthalmologist, 3 by 6 millimeters is actually quite large, and it's much larger than the macula itself. Is there any evidence that the implant is affecting the extrafoveal regions, which some patients with poor vision do use for vision?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Yeah, it covers, in most of our patients, it covered the entire macula. And we wanted it to cover the geographic atrophy area. We think right next to the GA, in the periphery of the GA, there are a lot of photoreceptors that are kind of sick that maybe we could rescue in the so-called transition zone. And we thought about making different sizes. Maybe a smaller size would work. And some investigators have tried making smaller implants. So I think it's still early days in regard to that. And, you know, one thing, when you start a clinical trial, you're kind of locked in. You can't make changes. In fact, the retinal surgeons would say, I don't like this tool. Could you put a bend in that? And I think you should make the handle longer. We say, oh, we can't, you know, we've got approval for this. It's part of the trial, maybe the next trial. So, so the extrafoveal region, yeah, good question. Again, related to the secretome, there could be things that are secreted that get there and help out. So we don't know that for sure. But yeah, you're right. It looks small, but yeah, in an eyeball, it's pretty large. And getting that, implanted took a lot of experimentation in the pig, and then going to the humans that had the GA, just hydrodissecting that area was really tricky. It's like you've got a rug stuck to the floor, and you take a hose and put it underneath there and squirt until the rug lifts up. So, but really good question. Thanks.
Okay, we'll take one last question on Zoom. Could you briefly comment on the status of photoreceptor cell replacement?
Ah, okay. Yeah. I mean, in some patients, you've already lost the photoreceptors. What do you do there? Could you combine RPE and photoreceptors and make like a little sandwich that you could put in there? And we've done a little work on that. I know that other people are further along there. For example, the company Opsis in Madison, Wisconsin, has made a lot of progress in making a clinical grade photoreceptor product and developed a scaffold that they could put those in. And for patients with retinitis pigmentosa, where it's a photoreceptor defect, wouldn't it be great if you could just replace the photoreceptors? The challenge there is, of course, the photoreceptor makes synapses with the rest of the retina, and it's a very complicated cell type. We started with RPE because it's a little simpler. It's not a neuron and it's a support cell. But a lot of people, a lot of labs around the world are working on making photoreceptors as well and maybe combining with RPE in the future.
Great. Thanks so much, Dennis. I don't see any more questions on Zoom, no more in the room. So let's thank Dennis for a terrific and inspiring talk.
Thank you.